Stefan Kung, just firstly, if you had to send a message to that final ramp, those final couple of kilometres, what would you say about it or to it?
Yeah, it's a ski slope. It's meant to descend, but we had to ride up. So yeah, interesting experience. But
Eddie Dunbar, how vicious, how horrible, how disgusting was that final ramp?
Yeah, it was pretty hard, but thankfully it was foggy, so you couldn't see what was ahead, so that helped a bit. But
you don't even bother looking. It's so steep, so you can't even see anyway with the fog. So it's just like just push as hard as you can, knowing that it's probably more or less 12 minutes. But it was. There's no point even looking because you're so buckled anyway. You're not doing the numbers that you wish you could see.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2024 Vuelta a España from Lisboa to Madrid.
Good evening, buenas tardes from Cutunegru, high up in the Asturian mountains. This evil, vicious, sadistic final ramp that you heard riders or various riders who had to scale this awful, well, the awful gradient I'm referring to before you heard my voice tonight. And the voices you did hear belong to Stefan Kung, Eddie Dunbar, and finally Ben O'Connor, still in red, still in the Mayo Rojo, maybe against the odds today after this 15th stage of Vuelta a España, joining me to discuss everything we saw. And it was a cracking, breathless, at times difficult to decipher stage, is young Richard Abraham. Richard, how are you?
Buenas tardes, Daniel. I'm very good. I'm very jealous of you. It's a guarantee of a good stage, isn't it, when you have to get a telecabine, whatever you'd call it in Spanish, up to the finish. Do you think?
Yes.
It always adds an element of fun to the day, at least, doesn't it?
A jeopardy. It adds an element of jeopardy to our experience as well. Although I must say the Vuelta a España tends to and deserves plaudits for organising things much better than the Giro d'Italia. Not quite as many people here, it has to be said, but today was beautifully organised and I was down from the finish very quickly, so quickly in fact that I was able to speak to Ben O'Connor in the mix zone, probably 15 minutes after he'd finished the stage. He barely towed himself down, so that was all very good. But Richard, I'm sitting in the mist. The location is barely more glamorous than the football dugout yesterday. I'm sitting on a sort of stone step outside a corrugated iron shed housing some kind of ski pieced maintenance equipment. I'm shrouded in the same mist, same fog, and fog it is really, not mist, because you can only see about 60 meters, I would say.
Is it
on
cold
television
up there?
Not particularly. I would say it's probably about 17 or 18, maybe 15 degrees. But we are at, well, here where I am, about 3 kilometers from the top, we are at, I guess, around 1,600 metres above sea level. Still a few fans up here. I'm sitting, well, next to the corrugated iron shed, opposite from one of the bars that sort of dot this mountainside. Quite an extensive network of ski lifts and ski pieces up here, and there are various buildings with cafes in them. That's where the press room has been today. Everyone's finishing up their work all around me, people doing pieces to camera, and as I said, fans enjoying a last beverage of the day. And well, they very much enjoyed what they saw, particularly the sort of patriotic Spanish fans enjoyed what they saw today. But Richard, we've got a lot to get through, so I propose, as we always do, we go back to this morning. We were in Asturias. I stayed in Oviedo last night, and the start was not too far from there in a place called Infiesto. And a reminder, the Vuelta a España began the day, we began the day with Ben O'Connor in the red jersey. He led Primoz Roglic by 1 minute and 21 seconds, Enric Mas by 3 minutes and 1 second, Richard Carapaz by 3 minutes and 13 seconds, and Mikel Landa by 3 minutes and 20 seconds. Many people predicted that this would be Ben O'Connor's last day in the red jersey. We already know it wasn't, but I and Other reporters spoke to him this morning in Infiesto. Here's what he said.
It's actually a climb that I would say probably suits me the most the rest of the of La Volta. So I can just try to go off that kind of like part of optimism and just try get it done. And the main thing is that there's no silly breakaway where you find yourselves in the back on the back foot straight away. And then with Felix and I, you know, it's a climb that suits me a lot more. So I expect us to both be together going into those final kilometres. And I think those are very much man-on-man kind of kilometres, those final 3Ks.
Richard, were you of the view, I can't remember what you said or what we said last night in the podcast, but were you of the view that this was going to be the last tango for Ben in the red jersey?
I can't remember what I said either. I thought it would be.
What did you feel, Richard? What did you feel in your waters?
In my bones when I woke up this morning. Yeah, I think probably I did think that it would be the last day in red. It felt like everything was just, the tide was just going Primoz Roglic's way. And I didn't really, I thought that once Roglic went on the final bit of Quito Negro, I thought that was kind of that. He'd been so well set up and, you know, it wasn't really attack, was it? It was just sort of riding away, which is the way to do it on that kind of climb. I thought that was that. And then, who was it that came back? It was Enric Mas, wasn't it, first? And then you just start to think, oh, this isn't what was the plan at the start of the day. And I think as soon as that happened, as soon as Roglic didn't start riding away, that was when I just thought, nah, this, it's not today.
Let's not spoiler too much. Let's not spoiler too much. One point of intrigue, certainly, as referred to in that interview, was going to be, we thought, the synergy or not between Ben O'Connor and Felix Gall. I was hoping there'd be more to discuss on that front, purely so that I might finally be able to crack out my full karaoke rendition of You Can Call Me Gal, as described, well, not premiered, but described at least, threatened the listeners with in last night's episode. However, that storyline sort of, well, it fell apart today, didn't it? Another point of discussion this morning, point of interest, at least as far as I was concerned, was, well, we heard yesterday from a couple of riders referring back to the Ancares stage where Primoz Roglic offered up a quintessential Roglification, and they said that that stage had suited him perfectly because it had been a not particularly hard day in the main peloton, and that's what he likes in general, that he can just unload all of his watts on a sort of 20-minute, 30-minute final climb. And if rivals wanted to make him suffer, they should maybe think about alternative tactics. I thought we'd just explore that theme. So I canvassed a couple of riders about precisely that this morning, and it might, well, their replies, their responses might offer a few sort of keys, a few clues as to what we saw, or a few sort of prisms through which we could interpret what happened later on in the stage. So we're going to hear on that subject from Jack Haig and former teammate of Primoz Roglic, George Bennett, who nowadays, of course, rides for Israel Premier Tech.
It's difficult because I think if you look historically at the way Visma or Jumbo raced with Primoz, they always had two distinct styles whenever they were racing with Jonas and when they were racing with Primoz. When it's with Jonas, you'll generally see them try and make it hard all day. And when it's with Primoz, you generally try to see them make it as easy as possible, and then he did one super hard effort at the end where he made really big difference. And if you saw the other day when he took a lot of time on everyone else in GC, it was a relatively easy stage up until when Movistar took it up, and then Primoz whacked it. So I think if they want to try and minimize this, maybe Movistar make it hard all day, and then you kind of blunten a little bit Primoz's full force. But like you said, then you run into the problem that you control all day, you get beaten by him anyway. So
it takes a lot of cojones, a lot of huevos.
Yeah, grande huevos. But no, we'll have to wait and see what happens here. But I think ideal scenario for Primoz is that it's as easy as possible. He gets to this last 2 and a bit kilometers, whacks it, puts another 50 seconds into Enric.
I remember even in like Catalonia this year with Sepp, they like to ride hard all day, you know. I think that they feel better than everybody else, and it works in their opinion, and it works in their favour, but everyone's caught up on the fueling, you know. It's not like that, but I think it does speak to Vingegaard's durability of just... And he was in front of Tadej for a long time in that regard, but Tadej obviously is now also the master of, let's say, durability. I think Roglic just has that such explosivity, but if it's really, really hard all day repeatedly, that's when you see guys like Jonas and coming to the front. So I think also Ben O'Connor is good at that. So, yeah, like we talked about yesterday, I think it will influence how we race today.
So, Richard, I was curious to see whether we might see Movistar and put their hand back in the fire. They'd sort of got burnt the other day. And I think, as I said in yesterday's podcast, unfortunately, with these manoeuvres, if you come out on the losing side, you can easily end the day with egg on your face, can't you? Because you're sort of condemned to win the stage. If you work all day and then your guy finishes third or fourth or fifth in the lead group, then it looks as though you've been rather silly. You know, the operation was a success, but the patient died, sort of thing.
Yeah, and well, in the end, they didn't have to, did they? Although,
no, I suppose, spoilers, Richard.
Sorry?
No more spoilers. No more spoilers.
I'll leave it there then.
Well, it's difficult. Yeah, it's difficult. I've kind of...
what shall I say instead?
I've kind of made it impossible. Well, we'll crack on to the tail of the etapa, shall we? All this suspense is killing us, killing everyone, I think.
El resumen de la etapa. The tail of the etapa.
So stage 15 in Fiesta to Coutu Negru, 142.9 kilometres, 3,729 metres of climbing. Four climbs, the Alto de la Coladiela, Category 1, Alto de Santo Emiliano, Category 3. The first climb of the day again, the Coladiela, Category 1. And then the final climb to Coutu Negru, special category climb, 1,847 metres above sea level. We've already given the general classification. O'Connor leading Roglic by 1 minute and 21. There were lots of attacks, as there always are early in the day. The first group that got away featured Jayvine Asgreen, Kasper Asgreen, Sudal Quickstep. Relevant for something we'll hear later on in the day. Frigo Sheehan of Israel Premier Tech, Gregard of Lotto Destiny, Meinkiz of Intermarché, Poul of DSM, Champion of Cofidis, and Castrillo. Remember, he was in the first significant move of the day. Richard, this was when I first heard that Felix Gall was struggling on that first climb of the day. I don't know if those reports were accurate, but again, relevant for something we will hear later. But it was a very reduced peloton, around about 25 riders over the top of the first climb. UAE were very active. They tried counter moves with Yates, Soler and Sivakov. Their tactics may have seemed a little bit confusing. It looked as though they were attacking each other at one point. But that first group that I mentioned, they were sort of absorbed, and a large peloton regrouped after, well, the peloton itself regrouped after the first climb. The following group formed before the second climb of the day: Soler, Pache, Meinkiz, Castrillo again, Izaguirre, Almirai, Sheehan and Gregard. Soon there were more attacks behind, and on the second climb of the day we had the following riders at the front: Kreiswijk, Sivakov, Almirai, Soler, Paris-Peintre, Dani Martinez, Alexander Vlasov, Sheehan again, Gregard, Kung, Pache, Lascano, Haig, Meinkiz, Izaguirre and Castrillo. Then a few more riders joined them: Oscar Rodriguez of Ineos Grenadiers, George Bennett, Marco Frigo and Lorenzo Fortunato. Jayvine was first rider over that climb. Meanwhile, further back in the peloton, or behind the peloton, Pelayo Sanchez, the only Asturian rider in the race, sadly abandoned. Sudal-Quickstep were pulling hard on the front of the peloton. Who knows what they were up to or had in mind. Second time up the Coladiela, UAE were driving exceedingly hard this time, and Soler eventually sat up and we saw the front group shedding riders. Old Jack Haig, poor old Jack, had a mechanical, I think, on this climb, and that put him out of contention. But soon, at the top of that climb, there were just, how many riders were together, Richard? It was Pache, Kung, Vine, Sivakov, and Castrillo. At this point, around about this point, 50 kilometres to go, they had a gap of 3 minutes. A little bit further down the road, about 15 kilometres later, we heard again that Felix Gall was dropped from the peloton. He had other Decathlon riders around him, but he would not see the peloton again. 35 kilometres to go, Stefan Kung got pretty feisty, pretty angry with a UAE team car who was trying to feed, I think it was Sivakov, and well, basically the direct sportive was sticking his hand out the window, and Stefan Kung had wanted to come between the team car and Sivakov to get the intermediate points, or the intermediate bonus seconds rather, and take them off Sivakov, who I should have said earlier on had started the day in 13th place in general classification, 6 minutes and 31 seconds down. So Kung was thinking about his teammate David Gourdou's GC position and was trying to take as many bonus seconds off Sivakov as possible. That was at around 35 kilometres to go. 20 kilometres later, King Kung, Stefan, was the first rider of that five-man group at the front to be dropped. I don't think I did mention, but I should have mentioned that Jay Vine had also gone at this point. Richard, was it around about here that we saw Primoz Roglic's bike change? Just before the foot of the final climb?
Yeah, it was just before. I mean, that it was quite difficult to tell exactly where the final climb started, because it was a sort of drag, well, from before that intermediate sprint up to the foot of the Pajares when went on to the finish. But yeah, more or less just before the categorised climb started. Roglic, well, it first looked like it might have been a mechanical issue, but then, well, he switched to a climbing bike, didn't he? It was a one-by setup. I think it was a 44-tooth sprocket on the back, bigger than the disc brake rotor anyway. And then, well, you missed this, Daniel, because you were in your gondola.
Yeah.
But television cameras did pick up Roglic spending a little bit too long behind the Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe car, along with a couple of teammates, I believe Roger Adria and Dani Martinez, who had stopped to accompany him.
And there would be consequences for that, but we would only find out what they were well after the stage finish. In fact, about 10 minutes before we started recording tonight. More on that in a minute. At the front, Quentin Pache had also been dropped. We now had three men in that front group with 10 kilometres to go. So a reminder, Sivakov, Castrillo and Vlasov. Now remember the Siv-El Vlas beef that we covered a few days ago. They'd apparently cleared the air. They were mates again. However, Pavel Sivakov had been pulling for an inordinate amount of time at the front. He'd got no help, zero pulls from Vlasov and Castrillo. He wasn't even asking them for help. But with 10 kilometres to go, they had an advantage still over the main peloton of 2 minutes and 55 seconds. Sudal Quickstep was still pulling very hard. Both groups neared this very steep, well, the very steep last 4 kilometres of the Cotul Negru climb. It was as the front group swung on to that very steep section that Pablo Castrillo stunned me, certainly, by launching a very vicious attack and dropping Pavel Sivakov, and Alexander Vlasov set off in pursuit. It wouldn't be the last of Castrillo's attacks, and he was all over the bike. It was certainly an exhibition of brute force. But finally, and I'm going to come back to the GC group in just a second, but finally Pablo Castrillo would hold off Alexander Vlasov to take a sensational second mountain stage victory of this Vuelta a España for Kern Farmer and for himself. Second mountain stage victory this week for Pablo Castrillo. Extraordinary result in more ways than one. Back to the general classification group. Mikel Landa, as you would have expected, given that his team had been pulling all day, he was the first to attack with about 6 kilometres to go on the first steeper ramps. Ben O'Connor was quickly onto his wheel. Primoz Roglic was also there as well, as were a little bit later to respond, Enric Mas, Richard Carapaz, and all of the chaps you would expect to be there. Really, there were multiple attacks, in fact, from Landa, and they were all marked out until Florian Lipovits pulled hard into the bottom of that final last 4 kilometer section, and this was to launch a Primoz Roglic attack. Primoz Roglic did accelerate with 3 kilometers to go, and briefly everyone was dropped, everyone was left in his wake. It looked at this point even as though he might catch Sivakov, Vlasov and Castrillo. However, with 1.4 kilometers to go, we saw Enric Mas emerge Stephen Roach-like through the mist to first catch up with Roglic and then to drop him. And, well, the story of what happened from then on in, really, is told by the stage results, Richard. And would you like to give them to us?
Yes. Well, behind that leading trio of Castrillo, Vlasov and Sivakov, as you said, you had Mas and Roglic. Surprise, at least to my eyes, was Matthias Skelmoser, sixth on the day, just behind Roglic by a matter of seconds. After him, it was Richard Carapaz, Sepp Kuss, Mikel Landa, David Goldu, and then, what are we, 38 seconds behind Enric Mas was Ben O'Connor, followed shortly by the man who'd set up Roglic, Florian Lipovits. After that, we had Adam Yates, Eddie Dunbar, and Carlos Rodriguez, who was in the white jersey at the start of the day, Sugar Man. And, well, we'll get onto this, no doubt. Well, that's, he no longer is.
Yeah, all changed. All changed. Let's move on to GC. Not huge gaps, maybe, between the main contenders. However, some significant movement in the general classification, particularly in positions 6 to 10, and also the time gaps between the top five as well have changed slightly. Richard, bring us up to date. How much does Ben O'Connor lead by?
Well,
tell us why that has changed in the last half an hour or so.
Ben O'Connor did lead the race by 43 seconds from Primoz Roglic. He now leads the race by 1 minute and 3 seconds from Roglic, because the UCI has docked Roglic 20 seconds in the GC for that manoeuvre behind the car once he changed his bike. So, pretty much negating half of the gains that he made on the road today, thanks to that.
And we then have
Mas at 2:23, Carapaz at 2:44, Landa at 3:05. Another little jump down to Lipovits, who's moved up into sixth. He's at 4:33. Gaudu in 7th at 4:39. A second behind Gaudu is Carlos Rodriguez, who, as we said, is now out of the white jersey. That's now on Lipovits' shoulders. Skelmoser gained 2 places today. He's at 4:51 in 9th. And Sivakov
gained three positions.
Now, 5:12. Yeah. And the best of the UAE riders just ahead of Adam Yates.
Now 5 minutes, 12 seconds down on Primoz Roglic. And I should also bring you up today on Felix Gal. We said that he'd had a tough day and we didn't know quite how tough. 129th on the stage. He lost 26 minutes, 10 seconds. Well, that's how far he came in behind Pablo Castrillo. And of course, he's well out of general classification. Now, a complete implosion from Felix Gal. We might find out in due course what that was due to, whether he's sick or simply had one of them bad days, one of those bad days that riders often talk about. Richard, without further ado, I think we should hear from some of the protagonists from today's stage. A very happy, I must say, beaming, in fact, Ben O'Connor. This was even before he knew that Primoz Roglic was 1 minute and 3 seconds behind, not 43 seconds behind. We're going to hear from him first. We will then hear from a disappointed but surprisingly, I think, sanguine Pavel Sivakov, given what he went through today, what he endured. And then we will also hear from Stefan Kung about that incident with the team car, the UAE team car with about 35 kilometers to go, and also about what he thought of Pablo Castrillo flicking El Civ to take the stage win. Well, Ben, that must go down as a good day, for you at least personally.
Yeah, it was a good day. It was really hard, actually. The all day was just really hard. And I got to say, this final climb here, this final like kilometer and a half was probably the worst. It's probably one of the worst climbs I've done in terms of the ending. It was filthy.
Felix, we know, didn't have such a good day. Was there any indication of that earlier on? Did you hear anything? Can you enlighten us at all about what happened to him?
I actually have no idea. I just heard Valentine wait for Felix, and then I didn't see him again. Didn't really hear much. So, yeah, Bish, I didn't expect it because he was so good. He's been so strong. So, yeah, there was a bit out of the blue. But I guess it happens in a Grand Tour.
I think it's 43 seconds now, the gap to Roglic. Would it be fair to say that you've got a bit more belief that you may be able to pull this off, a bit more than you did this morning?
I mean, even with the TT in the end, I think it would be difficult if I had a 40-second gap. I feel like that would be on par, but yeah, I think I just got to try and keep it as long as I can. You never know. Once again, you talk about Felix just before. If you have just one bad step, you might slip out once on the bike, and it can just take one little thing that can derail your whole race. So at the moment, 10 days in Jersey, pretty special, and I'm just going to try to rest a little bit, enjoy not having a race and do any more climbs tomorrow.
So thanks.
Very surprised that Quickstep rode the whole day after Sivakov.
I guess they had to. They were super strong. I actually just can't believe they managed to stay away in the valley, because it was so fast in the bunch. You couldn't have swapped off harder, and yeah, they were taking time out. It was pretty crazy. So I guess they had to.
Yeah, it also helped you a little bit.
Yeah, but in the end, it's not just for us to ride every single day, you know. I know Bora had Vlasov in front, but Pavel still could have jumped Primoz. Movistar had guys, and Pavel could have jumped Enric. I don't know about Carapaz if he had a guy there, but it's in everyone's interest anyway at some point, so it just depends who bites first.
Well, your team attacked all day. You worked for I don't know how many kilometres, you probably know better than me, 50 kilometres. Well, tell us, first of all, did you ask those guys if they could pull, if they were going to pull, and what did they tell you?
I mean, it was obvious they were not going to pull. I think with the team we came, we had a plan this morning and we stick to it. We did really amazing, everyone from the team, like, committed. I'm really, really grateful to everyone. And I couldn't pull it off at the end. It's a shame, but yeah, it's how it is. I think behind us we had like teammates from guys that are in front of me on GC, so obviously they didn't pull. And yeah, then basically in the last climb I just had to try to drop riders one by one, but I think it's really hard to do when I was already pulling on the flat in the valley. I was not completely cooked, but a bit cooked. So yeah, I couldn't win the stage.
Castrillo didn't pull. Why? Because he then attacked you at the bottom of the steep part and he won the stage.
I mean, it's obvious he wasn't going to pull, you know. If I would have asked him, I was going just with my tempo, and yeah, he attacked and Vlasov didn't react. I think he just stuck to my wheel, and at the end, yeah, he didn't catch him.
You were friends again a few days ago. Are you friends now?
Yeah, I mean, it's racing. It was obviously really annoying to see him in my wheel. But it was obvious that he wasn't going to pull. The annoying thing from Bora was just in the first part. When Mark and Jay were pulling, they were just making gaps in the downhill. That was not really fair play. But yeah, and then I also didn't understand why Quickstep pulled for Bora, basically. So that's how it is. I mean, I gave it everything. No regrets. The team was amazing. So.
Stefan, just a couple more things. The I think it was at the intermediate sprint when you were sort of cut off and by a hand out of the UAE team car. Just tell us what happened.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, I wanted to do the sprint, like, just to take away the seconds of Sivakov. And just actually at the moment I was diverting and launching my sprint, the team car passed and handed out the baton. So, yeah, I rode into the hand of the DS. And in the end he told me, yeah, but the commissar said I could pass. But so, yeah. I mean, it's not what you expect when you're sprinting and suddenly, there is a hand in your way.
And just lastly, Stefan, in that group, Sivakov was pulling for a long, long time. And then Castrillo gets to the bottom of this steep ramp and attacks him and wins the stage. I mean, is that fair? Pavel said he didn't expect Castrillo to do any work, but it seems strange.
Yeah, because Pavel, he was riding for the GC. It's also the reason why none of us were taking turns, because in the end you can say, oh, but he's like, I don't know, 2 minutes behind David, but in the end you never know what happens, and so we're not going to give him a hand, and he knows this. And Castrillo, I mean, he was only in for the stage win, and it's just, I think Pavel had the bigger goal of the GC, and chapeau to Castrillo, because he also had to beat Vlasov, who also wasn't riding.
Perfect. Thanks, Stefan. Cycling's cheers. Well, Richard, we'll hear from Primoz Roglic in a few minutes, I think. But I thought, well, that was a decent representation, decent cross-section of opinion on some of the things that happened today. Who was working all day, why they were working, whether they did a good job, made a good decision or not. And I'm mainly referring to Sudal Quickstep, of course. And the Castrillo stage win is another matter, I suppose, whether Pavel Sivakov should have been, or was entitled to think he might have contributed a little bit more than he did. Well, he contributed not at all. He did absolutely nothing before flicking El Civ to take the stage win. I didn't mention that there was a bit of a change on the King of the Mountains, or in the King of the Mountains competition, certainly as far as, well, how close that now is, because we've got Jay Vine level on points with Wout van Aert. They're both on 46 at the top of the general classification. Wout van Aert will be in the green jersey for the foreseeable future. So Jay Vine will ride stage 16 to Lagos de Covadonga in that rather fetching white and, well, with blue polka dot jersey. Richard Castrillo, I must admit, I was standing beyond the finish line in the mist, surrounded by soigneurs, watching Pavel Sivakov absolutely bury himself for 40 kilometers or so, and I felt slightly aghast when Castrillo attacked at the bottom of that very steep ramp. And I was quite surprised by how sort of phlegmatic everyone was in their, some of the riders we heard from in their interviews about whether this was on or not. Because, okay, Sivakov was a threat on general classification, but I do think that a big part of Sivakov's motivation, and UAE's motivation today, was the stage win, which put them in the same boat as Castrillo, effectively. And I don't think he was so close on general classification. We said earlier, approximately 6 minutes down he started the day, that everyone else could just hold their hands up and go, well, you're going to gain so much from this that we can just, you know, sit in the back seat of your limousine. What do you think?
Yeah, and not only that, Jay Vine was pulling pretty much the whole time before Sivakov took over as well, wasn't he? Obviously, he benefited in the KOM competition, but it was a really strange tactic, and I wonder when the last time Sivakov actually had the opportunity to ride kind of for himself in that situation, because it struck me that he was doing a fine job were one of the two riders on his wheel on the same team. If he were pulling like you saw him pulling in, was it the Tour or the Giro? I momentarily forget which one he did.
The Tour.
Yeah. If you saw him pull like that on a mountain stage for Pogacar, then that would make perfect sense and the performance would have been spot on. But to ride like that when you're trying to benefit yourself seems slightly perplexing. I'm not sure, you know, whether he expected or whether anybody would really expect Vlasov and Castrillo to voluntarily go to the front when it was so clear that UAE were hell bent on doing that and making the break stick. It seemed really peculiar to me. In fact, the whole tactics of UAE seem sort of maybe slightly Solarian in the sense that it was madness, wasn't it, in that first hour and a half of racing, groups going big, you know, big splits in the peloton that then came back together, a break went, came back, another group went away again, and UAE were always trying to force it, but it felt like it maybe lacked a little bit of the kind of finesse or maybe like cohesion that you might see from, say, Ineos or Visma Lisa Bike, another team in this year's race. It just felt sort of like a sledgehammer being swung around wildly, and it did a lot of damage, but ultimately, what, third on the stage? Well, did Sivakov seem happy with that?
Well,
I mean, he's still a long way off the GC, isn't he? He's still a good chunk of time behind sort of top five, so it wasn't...
I mean,
he got into the top 10, but it's not...
No, it's not a career-changing result. An extraordinary ride, I think, and an extraordinary performance, and an extraordinary sort of physical performance by Jay Vine as well. And you might say, well, they were condemned to do that by Soudal Quickstep pulling that hard. However, you know, Soudal were pulling that hard because UAE had gone about things so aggressively in the first half of the race. And we talked yesterday about the craft, the sort of savoir-faire of getting into breaks. Well, when you are in breaks, then there's also a real art to playing that game of poker with the main peloton and sometimes slowing down to sort of lure them into a false sense of security. And what it turned into was just a slugfest between UAE and Soudal, or T-Rex, effectively. And having committed three high-quality riders, Soler, Jay Vine, and Sivakov, and done it with such gusto straight away, they perhaps ruled out any possibility of the other riders in that group helping them. I think they were maybe unlucky in the sense that, for example, I mentioned Jack Hay getting a mechanical. I think Jack probably would have chipped him with a bit of help for Sivakov, and that would have maybe given him the necessary freshness to look. He wasn't far off winning the stage anyway. He said in the interview we just heard he was cooked even on the flat in the valley because he'd done so much work. I don't think he'd have needed much more help to be able to contest the stage win, and then who knows, that group would have gained the extra minute which would have made that whole endeavour even more worthwhile for him on two fronts: stage win possibility and GC gain possibility. But it made for a great race.
You have to be willing to lose in order to win.
Yes,
and that's often the case, isn't it? When you think of a small group coming into, let's say, the end of Paris-Roubaix.
Yes,
you know what Sivakov did there was essentially lead them through the last few cobbled sectors all the way into Roubaix and then lead out the sprint in the velodrome. And
yes,
well, of course, you're going to get beaten in that situation. So, and the likes of what Kung was in that group as well, you know, with another rider there, Quentin Paché. So Kung could have perhaps been convinced to do a bit of riding. He would have been pretty useful in that scenario, certainly before it got steep. So, yeah, it didn't make an awful lot of sense to me. But that shouldn't take anything away from Castrillo as well. I mean, having the guts to kind of sit there and just, I don't know, I don't think I ever saw Sivakov look round. I didn't see Vlasov or Castrillo shake their heads at all.
It was very noble.
No question asked, was there?
It was very noble. And I'm usually of the view that sort of all is fair in love and war in professional cycling. And I quite like the sort of, you know, flick or be flick nature of professional cycling. And I kind of think that the winner is always right and is always vindicated. However, you know, maybe it's because we're slightly biased because Pavel Sivakov is a guy who, you know, he's got a long-standing association with the cycling podcast. So I found it almost disturbing to see him be crucified in this, or to sacrifice himself on whatever altar it was in this way. And maybe for that reason, it seems slightly mendacious of Pablo Castillo to attack him as soon as they got to that steep ramp, when my presumption up until that point was that Castillo had been telling Sivakov he was cooked. But what I gathered from what Pavel said and what Stefan Kung also said was that no, it was more of a tactical sort of decision, or whereby, or on Castrillo's part, or a resolution that no, look, you're gaining GC from this, you're getting your reward from this breakaway, so I'm not helping. I'm gonna enter the fray in the last couple of kilometers when the stage victory is up for grabs.
Well, I read some quotes from Castrillo which had been reported by AS kind of immediately after the stage, and you know, they were saying that he did feel low on energy on the long drag. Well, it wasn't even a drag, it's steeper than that, isn't it? But the Puerto de Pajares, before we get really steep, he was low on energy there, and he said that that attack on the final 3 kilometers, when that there was that the right turn and it got super steep, that gave him energy. He said that that attack gave me wings to go full throttle. I mean, it seemed absurd, it seemed really quite a silly thing to do. The ferocity of that attack was almost as if he thought the finish was 500 meters from where they were rather than 3 kilometers, and you know, a long 3 kilometers at that. But it was remarkable, wasn't it? And incredibly cinematic as well, despite the mist, or perhaps because of it. This sort of slugging match between him and Vlasov, so evident, you know. And I think it's partly, I don't know if you noticed this, Daniel, as well, neither of them were wearing their glasses. They had them both.
Yeah.
Well, Castrillo's one on top of his helmet. I'm not sure what Vlasov's done with his, but you could really see their faces. And that's often, you know, people like to look back at the golden days of cycling with rose-tinted glasses. But it is true that you can't always see that much of people's faces anymore. And that was a part of it. And the way that Castrillo was just sort of fighting himself and Vlasov and kept surging and finding something else in reserve was astonishing, really, for a rider of his size, I suppose, as well. But then, you know, maybe on La Manzanera the other day, the riders could be forgiven for not treating him seriously is the wrong word, but perhaps being surprised by just how strong he was, because he's a guy who rides for Keon Farmer, it's his first Grand Tour, and so on and so on. But there were no excuses this time, really, I don't think, for being surprised, at least, by what he did.
No, well, we said the other day that he's bound for the World Tour. We don't know exactly where yet. The rumour has been that he will go to Ineos Grenadiers next year. I said the other day that I believe that deal has not been done and may even have hit a snag with other teams hovering. I also said that I hoped, for his sake, he hadn't signed yet. Well, I certainly hope that he hasn't signed yet, or he hadn't signed maybe in the interim, in the 3 or 4 days since that first stage win, because he'll be able to demand even more now.
Part of me, the hopelessly romantic part of me, hopes that he stays with Kern, because it sort of, at least in this welter, it allows him to do these slightly surreal, exciting, fun things.
Well,
I don't really know what... It's never going to happen.
Staying with Kern Farmer would be a surreal decision at this point. I'm sorry.
That would be a surreal
decision. No disrespect
decision.
To Kern Farmer.
No, you're right. But I wonder what Castrillo, if and when he joins the World Tour, what he would go on to do. You know, do we know whether he's a sort of GC prospect?
I suspect not. I mean, I've heard him pigeonholed as a guy who could become a sort of all-terrain domestique and could be very useful in that role in Grand Tours, the sort of role that Jonathan Castroviejo has fulfilled over the last few years. I believe sort of, he may have been hit him out for that.
Part of the sport, but it's also slightly sad when you see a guy who's clearly got the instinct to win and win well, you know, getting pushed into a sort of super domestique role on a World Tour team. Anyway,
Richard, we should move on to discuss what happened on general classification. And well, it I wouldn't say it looked when he crossed the line like a good day for Primoz Roglic, but it was certainly a day on which he seemed to have inched closer to this holy grail of a fourth Vuelta a España title. Then things changed slightly, as already discussed. Let's hear first what Primoz Roglic said when he did cross the line up there on Kutu Negru.
Yeah, I don't know how much we lose actually compared to the red jersey. He was in front.
Red jersey is behind you. So maybe 15 and 20 seconds behind.
I mean, still a good performance. It was a tough week, tough day today. Still better to gain something, than lose 15. So very happy.
How did your legs feel when you hit that 24% gradients there in the final 2 kilometers?
Better. I was more suffering with the less steep gradient. So, the end was quite fine.
Were you a bit caught off guard when Enric Mas caught you and then dropped you on a terrain that I think would suit you better?
Yeah, was hard. He's in super good shape. He went really good. So, like I said, sometimes you gain a bit, sometimes you lose. You shouldn't go with the head through the wall. So, I'm happy. For sure, better 45 than 5 minutes 45, so happy.
So, Richard, a slightly disoriented Primoz Roglic. He seemed to think that Ben O'Connor had finished ahead of him. I don't know whether that was just me getting the wrong end of the stick, but I think he was fairly pleased, as much as one can ever decipher anything from anything Primoz Roglic says at bike races. But that 20-second penalty, It's careless. Some would argue that it was careless to even think about a bike change, which would put you in that position, given what you stood to gain. I doubt very much that the sport scientists at Red Bull, Bora Hansgrohe, told Roglic that he could gain sort of 15, 20 seconds. We'd be talking about smaller margins than that. So some would say that it was a reckless decision to even plan a bike change. He did one the other day before Ancares as well. I do believe he changed to the same bike that day. But now, having lost that time, I said to Ben O'Connor that maybe... The pendulum has sort of swung slightly back in Ben O'Connor's direction, albeit still ultimately pointing to Primoz Roglic. But has Enric Mas, will he look at that and think, I wonder?
Yeah, Mas was really impressive today. When you watch a cricket match or listen to a cricket match, they have this thing called WinViz that somehow looks at the state of play and works out a percentage of who's going to win and the percentage likelihood of a draw. And I think it's still majority towards Roglic after today. And at least if I were plugging in WinViz purely on what I feel like saying, rather than any statistical analysis at all. With a few more mountains to come, what is there? There's Lagos de Covadonga immediately after the rest day.
There's two mountain top finishes. Yeah, two.
And then the time trial.
There's another mountain top finish, Mont Calvillo, where he has won before as well. He's won at Lagos de Covadonga and he's won at Mont Calvillo as well. So
I think a minute, on today's showing, a minute is fine for Roglic to be behind Ben O'Connor, because Ben O'Connor would have to be pretty much glued onto Roglic's wheel on all of those occasions. It's easy for Roglic, relatively speaking, to gain that minute back, I think, if he's got four opportunities to do it.
Yes.
Mas, however, Mas has gained 20 seconds on Roglic today, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And I wonder what the sort of the psychological impact of seeing Roglic go and then reeling him back in. And, they really telegraphed it, didn't they, with that bike change, what Roglic was planning.
Yeah.
And the fact that Movistar didn't really have to do that much today. They threw, was it Lazcano at one point? A bit of pulling with T-Rex Quickstep. But besides that, they had a pretty easy ride as a team, and then Mas was able to stick with Roglic. So, yeah, this is what we said the other day, wasn't it? Mass is perhaps the one to be watching. I'd be of that opinion, I think, still.
I think we have to caveat all of this by saying that this is exactly what we had been saying for several days, that of all of the stages, this would suit well. And this is what the riders themselves, they were saying. Ben O'Connor had been saying for a few days that this stage would suit him more than Ancares. Eric Mas had been saying that this stage would suit him more than Ancares. They'd also been saying that this stage wouldn't particularly or might not particularly suit Primoz Roglic. Another factor I would, another consideration I would add into that, think back to what we heard at the start of the podcast today, what Jack Haig said and George Bennett said about Primoz Roglic's sweet spot in terms of multi-mountain climbs, and he generally reacted well and liked it when the day, when the prelude to the final climb wasn't too hard and the racing wasn't too intense. And what we did get today was a very intense race because of what Sudal Quickstep did. I don't think they were particularly thinking about making life hard for Roglic. They were thinking about other things, the fact that they didn't have anyone down the road. They were thinking about a stage win for Mikel Landa. They were thinking about Mikel Landa's GC position as well. But I do think that this fitted the profile perfectly of a Roglic slightly off day. And he only looked below his best, below par for sort of the last 1.5 kilometers, I would say, of this climb today. It was far from a disaster, and indeed for most of it he looked very good. But I think this fitted the script. It followed the script exactly. If we are to sort of take that as our position, then we can also look at what everyone's been saying about the climbs next week and say that, okay, Picon Blanco might be a day a bit like today, multiple climbs. It might be a hard race all day because there'll be lots of teams fighting for various things, podium positions and so on and so on. But Moncalvillo should suit Roglic, and Covadonga may also suit Roglic, and he'll be just fine. However, it's another day with that 20-second penalty. It's another ride aboard the Roglic coaster. Just when you think you're home and dry with old Rog, he just hints that it might all go. He might all go. The Rogler coaster might go off the rails.
Is it like that point in the, you know, when you're going up the start of a roller coaster and it maybe it just stops and you're just left there just for a little bit too long, wondering what's going on.
Yes.
Whether something's gone wrong.
That is the life and times.
And then it carries on again.
The life, times, and career of Primoz Roglic.
Probably worth saying, Vlasov and Lipovic looked superb today as well for Red Bull, didn't they? Lipovic didn't have the best day on Ancares, did he? Not that he was miles off, but that could be quite important, I think. Those two look like they've got pretty good form going into the last week in support of Roglic. And then Gal, I suppose, well, it's pretty clear now that assuming he recovers after the rest day and can get back into the race, then, well, he's on, there's no GC for him to defend.
All hopes.
He'll be supporting O'Connor now,
all,
you would assume.
All hopes of Paul Simon Karaoke have been dashed, alas. Richard, I propose we conclude the part with the day's meeting of the day, Encuentro del Día, and this is, well, we're going to get slightly meta here because this is a meeting of the day about a meeting of the day that takes place every day on the Vuelta a España, and indeed at every race where Primoz Roglic is present, and the Sudal Quickstep or T-Rex Quickstep rider Casper Asgreen is present. Now, I read about this little, well, curious aside on a Danish website a few days ago. Casper Asgreen explains it pretty well, I think, in the meeting of the day, which was held this morning with me at in Infiesto. But basically, a superstition and a tradition have developed out of, well, an argument that Asgreen and Roglic had in 2020. I'll say no more, and I will present you with today's Encuentro del Día, Casper Asgreen.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Hey, Casper. Casper, I just wanted to ask you whether you could tell this story this story that's been sort of reported in the Danish press over the last few days about your unusual kind of connection with Primoz Roglic. And this dates back to something that happened in 2020. Am I right? Can you just summarize the story for us?
It's just a fun little, tradition, you could call it at this point, between Primoz and I, just to find each other on the stage and give each other knuckles just for good luck. And it's become a nice little tradition.
And it originated how? Can you just tell us? It was initially a bit of an argument between you and the 2020 tour, wasn't it?
Yeah. One of the, I don't remember exactly which stage it was. One of the first stages, and we were fighting over the same position. And then after the day, we just found each other in the neutral and said all good, no hard feelings, and that was it.
And then, well, we know what happened at La Planche des Belles Filles. But did that come after a day when you hadn't touched knuckles, and then you said to him, well, look what happens when we don't do that to each other?
Oh, it was that day. Obviously, it was a time trial, so everybody has their own. Yeah, it was the Planche des Belles Filles time trial, so everybody has a bit of their own schedule, and we weren't together in the bunch. I don't think it had anything to do with his performance that we didn't fist bump that day, but it was just a fun little coincidence, and now it's become our little thing.
And finally, just to bring the story up to date, did you do it when he passed you on the climb in Ancares a few days ago?
Yeah. I was looking back to look for Mikel, and I see him coming full steam and with the arms stretched out, and looking for the knuckles, because I went in the breakaway at kilometer zero, so we didn't manage to do it early in the stage like usual.
So as long as he keeps doing it, then he'll win this Vuelta, unless Mikel Landa wins the Vuelta.
Yeah, my teammates have been joking I should flick him one day, but let's see.
Thanks, mate. Thanks. So, Richard, the meeting of the day there, Casper Asgreen. We know now if Primoz Roglic doesn't win the Vuelta a España, it will be because Casper Asgreen has snubbed him one day, not giving him the sort of fist bump as he did on the, or as he did not on the day, the fateful day of La Planche des Belles Filles. Thought it was a nice little story, curious little story. I don't know, Richard, maybe you'll be able to tell me, because as was the case today, often in the key kilometres, in effect, of some of these stages, I'm on the mountain stages in particular, I'm in a ski lift, or I'm sort of trudging up a mountain to try to get to the finish on time. So I do miss things, as listeners will probably have gathered, in the closing kilometres of some of these stages. Did we see on television Primoz Roglic fist bump Casper Asgreen as he rode past him on the Ancares stage?
On the Ancares, did you stage? See
it? Yes,
the other day.
Yes, when Asgreen was down the road and Roglic passed him, we didn't see that.
I didn't. Well, not noticed. I didn't notice it. That's okay. Not, it wasn't on telly. No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Apparently, it did happen, and hence Roglic won the stage. Yes, we'll be looking out for that over the next few days. Richard, we are nearing the end of your stint, your innings on the Vuelta a España this year for the cycling podcast, but we've got a cracking last week in store. Rob Hatch will be joining me from Tuesday. Tuesday we will still be in Asturias, just, but we will be heading, well, after that we'll be heading into Cantabria and then the Basque Country, into Burgos, and then finally towards Madrid. And, well, everything is still finally poised. We didn't necessarily believe that would be the case, but we certainly hoped it would be. Richard, I think it's time not to talk about tomorrow's stage, because tomorrow will be a genuine rest day. The first genuine rest day of the Vuelta a España. I'm glad to say, after our 10-hour odyssey to get from Granada to Galicia on the first rest day. Won't be doing too much tomorrow. Got a couple of appointments maybe, but hope to have a rest. But it is time, Richard, not to talk about tomorrow's rest day, but to talk about what comes after that. We're going to call it tomorrow's stage, but you get the picture. Tuesday stage to the Lagos de Covadonga.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Richard, as promised, yesterday's dinner was a Mexican, and I did have tacos. You talked about
how was your taco van der Horns? Are they good?
Vegan taco, very good. At a restaurant in Oviedo, a couple of margaritas of the non-pizza variety, but yes, a very, very responsible drinking last night, Richard, as is the case every night. Rest day from running today as well. Rest day from running. Should have felt fully recharged. However, that was not the case. When you're on a grand tour, as soon as you let the sort of intensity levels drop, as was the case with me today, because it didn't go running, you just tend to crash. And that has also been the case with me today. I've been very tired, so I do need that rest day tomorrow. Richard, I promise I will be back full of energy on Tuesday for this... well, fantastic stage to the Lagos de Covadonga, mythical, legendary location in Vuelta a España history.
Well, Spanish history as well, isn't it?
It is.
I've said that, but I now have completely forgotten the story as to why Covadonga, and there's a church there, isn't there?
Yeah, it's to do with the Reconquista.
That's right. There was a battle there, wasn't there, at some point in the Reconquista?
I think it was the key battle. The key battle.
Well, there you go.
Yes, it is traditionally regarded as the foundational event, the kingdom of Asturias, and thus the start of the Reconquista. That was way back in the 8th century. The Reconquista lasted a long time after that. But yes, Richard, a very famous location in Spanish cycling. We were there in 2021. Primoz Roglic won there in 2021 with probably the most spectacular individual performance of Primoz Roglic's career. About a 60-kilometer raid initially with Egan Bernal. He then dispensed with Bernal at the bottom of the Lagos de Covadonga climb and won alone, solo, on his way. That was his last, in fact, his third Vuelta a España victory, of course. He's hoping that he'll take a fourth a week today in Madrid. But before that stage in 2021, we did sort of canvas riders about their memories of Covadonga, either watching it on television or riding Covadonga, what they associated with the climb. And, well, 3 years ago, way back in 2021, we asked, among others, the Lynx of Marbella, Luis Ángel Mate, who was riding that Vuelta a España, what he associated with the Lagos de Covadonga. Here's what he said.
My first memory was when I was one little boy in the summer with my family in the television. I think the Lagos de Covadonga was one of the first stages of La Vuelta in the television, in the live television. I am Luis Ángel Mate, the Lynx of Marbella, Euskaltel Euskadi. I have also another really good memory in the last Vuelta of my friend Michele Scarponi. I was in the breakaway. He was in the group of favorites with Froome, Contador, Valverde, Quintana. And he drove it a little bit, the group. I was in the breakaway and I helped it a little bit for coming to the top group. Yeah, it's a mythical climb here in Spain and always bad weather. We hope this year a little bit sun. But yeah, I think it's one of the most mythical climb of this Vuelta. The landscape is amazing. The north of Spain is Picos de Europa. It's one of the most so much place in Spain, with grizzly, with a lot of animals. In the television we can't never see because the weather is not always the best, but we hope to tomorrow we can see. It's a really nice landscape.
So Richard, many memories, bad memories for a lot of riders. Lagos de Covadonga, it's a tough climb. It's not the longest climb, and it's not the highest climb either. Only 1,069 meters is the summit of Lagos de Covadonga. I'm just going to bring up the statistics now. The final climb is 12.5 kilometers, 6.9%. Slightly deceptive. There are some very steep ramps on the Lagos de Covadonga climb. And interestingly, the profile on Tuesday is very reminiscent of the profile on that day in 2021 when Primoz Roglic romped away. He attacked on the Collada Yomena, which also features on the route and is the penultimate climb on Tuesday. So we've got that to look forward to. Richard, we're going to have one more interview to play out with tonight. But before we do, I'm going to thank you for your outstanding input this week. And also, well, given that you won't be with us, ask you what you expect to happen over the next few days.
Oh, sprung that on me.
You don't generally do predictions. Or a wish. A wish, then.
A wish.
What would you like to happen?
Oh, no,
don't betray your your journalistic impartiality.
I don't know. Maybe I'll go with a more kind of... I feel like a wish is more betraying of impartiality than a guess, isn't it? I think there will be another Wout van Aert breakaway or two, and I think that will add a little bit of spice into the KOM competition in the final week. As for the GC, I don't know. Here's a wish. Marc Soler finally gets something to reward the amount of effort and energy that he has expended doing whatever he's been doing in the last sort of 10 days or so. That would be nice to see. I'm not sure it's going to happen, but it would be nice.
I can almost guarantee, without any fear of contradiction, that we will see a lot of Marc Soler in the last week. I think the Solera coaster rivals the Roglic coaster as the most sort of, well, harrowing ride in the whole theme park of professional cycling, I would say. Richard, I will take this opportunity to thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been a pleasure.
Your input this week. And we'll be hearing from you after the Vuelta a España. Mm-hmm. I promise one last interview today. This refers back to an Encuentro del Día that we had early in the Vuelta with an Italian rider called Luca Vergalito of Alpecin de Koenig, also known as Il Bandito, famed for stealing Strava KOMs before he won the Zwift Academy and became a professional rider. Now, I've been noticing that Luca posts, comes up with some pretty interesting and at times quite oblique cryptic titles for his activities on Strava. He logs every stage of the Vuelta a España on Strava, and the titles can be quite descriptive. As I say, sometimes they're quite cryptic. And I thought today I'd review his Vuelta a España by getting him to explain the activity titles for every day. So here's Luca Vergalito talking to me this morning in Infiesto. I'll be back with Rob Hatch on Tuesday. Well, Luca, it was a week or so since we last talked. You seem to be enjoying your Vuelta. You've been in a lot of breakaways, very aggressive. I mean, looking at your Strava. Strava, of course, is one of the reasons you're famous. Yeah. So we're on the Il Bandito account, that's your account, and you're giving some interesting titles to some of the activities on Strava. Let's go backwards. Number 14, stage 14 yesterday, MotoGP with a little emoji of a motorbike.
Yeah, because it was super fast stage. I think it was one of the... I think on Strava it was listed as the second fastest 180k. Yeah, because the breakaway was really strong, and then Jumbo wanted to control the stage, so... and also for the moto, because he is riding a bit too close to the peloton, so it was like I don't know, 2 hours, like 48 average or something like that. So it was really fast.
And of course, the stage win for your teammate as well. Well, stage 13, ninth. That's where you finished. Yeah. Good day.
Yeah, it was a good day. So yeah, nothing to add. It was nice to be in the breakaway. It was nice to be in the breakaway with Caden, who helped me a lot. I didn't have the best legs. The other breakaways, I was feeling a bit better, but I think we are all tired, so it's normal.
Giro Pomeridiano, we don't need to talk about that. Afternoon ride, just a simple afternoon ride. Problemi gambe. On what stage was that? What was the stage in Galicia?
After recovery day, I think.
Yeah, stay after the rest day. Props in your legs. What were the problems?
Just legs were not working as they should. Probably also because of rest day. I don't know if it's more mental or more physical, but a lot of guys after the rest day are feeling bad. And there is always in the peloton, there is always a bit of fear after the rest day, because we know that you basically you race really hard for 7 or 9 days in this case, and then you have a rest day that it's good because you rest, but it also interrupts a bit the morning routine, the routine of the day. So probably at the end something bad is happening to the body.
Next one we'll talk about. Number 9, was it necessary?
Yeah, number 9 was the stage where Adam Yates won. It was too hard, honestly. Like I think one lap of the climb was enough, and not two. Also, it was super hot after a really hard week. So yeah.
Lots of only 8 comments for that one, actually. 1 kilometer too long. Well, that was this is stage 8. Yeah. We try again. So that was the stage of Cazorla. So that was another really good day for you.
Yeah, probably was the best day so far. I was 12th at the finish, but still 1K to go. I was there to win the stage with the Teada. So yeah, 1K too long.
Number 6, we try again. That was another day when you were in the break.
Yeah, with Ben O'Connor.
It's an intriguing one. Number 5, AirPods needed. Were you bored that day?
Yeah, I had to control the stage with Gesink, with Robert, for Caden, for the sprint in Sevilla. Just long straight, moderate pace. So normally in training this is fine because I listen to podcast or music, but here was too much.
Okay, I'm just gonna ask you one more. Number 4 in the oven. Yeah. I mean, we all know what it means. Yeah. But did you suffer heat? A lot of riders suffered heat stroke in that first week. Did you have any serious problems?
No, but here I was suffering a bit because we did the first climb really full gas, and it was like 40 degrees. And on top of the climb, I was feeling. But luckily, then we slowed down. But I didn't suffer a lot, also because I think the peloton was. We were riding a bit slower probably than because everybody was fearing that maybe the heat stroke was coming. So, and also all the teams are really well equipped with the ice and ice slurry, cold water. So we were able to survive.
Okay. Well, look, today the title, I don't know what the title will be, Rampa Inumana or Cuesta de Cabra, Goat Track. Well, hopefully Vittoria di Tappa.
Rampa Inumana. Thank you.
Good luck. Thank you. Gracias.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.